This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Over the past 5 months, Syria, like many of the other states in the Middle East, has been rocked by a revolutionary uprising and a violent governmental crackdown. Wendell Stevenson is a contributor for The New Yorker, and she recently traveled to the country. Her article, Roads to Freedom, appears in the most recent issue of the magazine, and she joins us now from Cairo. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Hasn't the foreign press been banned from Syria? How were you able to get in?
I'd rather not say. At the risk of sounding overly mysterious, it's a little bit tricky and a little bit dodgy, and I'd just rather not go into it. But nothing particularly illegal, I'd like to point out.
Did you travel alone?
I did, yes.
Can you give us a sense of what the overall mood in Syria was while you were there? Excitement, fear, paranoia?
I think the latter two. I was in Damascus. I wasn't able to leave. I was trying to be cautious and low to the ground and only really talk to people I knew and friends and friends of friends and this sort of thing, and to stay in areas where it would be kind of normal for a foreigner to be. There are very few foreigners there. The embassy staff are drawing down. There's a couple of sort of lingering foreign language students, Arabic students, but that's about it. It was also Ramadan for most of the time I was there, so the streets were sort of empty, emptier than usual. But it was overwhelmingly indescribably tense. You know, fearful, paranoia, a long, attritive, corrosive campaign. And my friends and people I talked to there really were sort of in the deep psychological trenches of having to just mentally get through stuff day to day. A lot of people complained to me they couldn't sleep. People were not able to concentrate. Do you know what I mean? Whether exams were coming up or they had a project they wanted to do or they just couldn't concentrate. You know, it's just a sort of hard to think back, hard to imagine forward, and stuck very much in a day-to-day kind of survivalist mode.
Well, each country is unique, but is this uprising much different than others we've seen in the Arab Spring?
They are all kind of unique, and it's hard to, you know, it's fun to compare and contrast, but it's also a little bit of a trap. I think that it's been consistently intense, and there's been sort of not a lot of respite. You know, I think there was a month or a bit longer when Hama was essentially kind of liberated or emptied from security forces, and there have been moments in other cities and towns when security forces have pulled back or pulled out or been redeployed, or there have been a sort of a window or a breather. But it's the campaign, the uprising, the revolution, or whatever you want to call it, has been really characterized by the regime's fire stamping. You know, something erupts and they try and stamp it out, and then you get a little gap. And it's hard to tell what's coming next. It's hard to tell week to week where that's going to happen, how that's going to happen, and all of that insecurity is just exhausting.
Could Hosni Mubarak have done something similar in the country you're in now, in Egypt? Because there's nothing like Tahrir Square in Damascus, is there?
Yeah, it's partly a little bit geography that Damascus is a really rather, well, it's one of my favorite places, but a beautiful city of lots of squares and roundabouts without a sort of one being a focal point in a sort of real way that Tahrir was, because it has government buildings and the Egyptian Museum and stuff around it. So it's partly that, but it's more really just a sense of, you know, the pervasive fear that's engendered there, I think.
What about in some of the other cities where we've seen major protests in Syria? Do they have central squares, or are they much like Damascus?
The difficulty with the central square idea and why it hasn't worked in Syria is that once you have a central square, you have a place for the security forces and the regime to defend. And that it was very clear to me in Damascus, the center of which the regime has been very careful to draw a red line about. They don't want anybody being able to gather or mass anywhere there. And so people have been going to suburbs, in alleys, in smaller places, in places where it's harder for security to mass or to see them. And so the square example of Tunis and Egypt just doesn't translate in the same way because the tactics are different. I think you asked if Mubarak had been able to do something like Bashar al-Assad is doing. And I think, you know, it's sort of horribly impressive that he consistently over several months managed to get reasonable, you know, quantities of Syrians to kill and shoot and stop other Syrians. Mubarak was not able to do that.
Well, many of the smaller squares have security forces posing as vendors. So if you see a falafel seller standing around waiting for business, do you just immediately assume that he's really working for the government?
Well, it's kind of weird. It's sort of hard to explain. I mean, I had protesters describe these kind of fake vendors, security guys, thugs really is what they are, sort of bust in for the occasion and paid piecemeal. And I had heard them describe this, and I thought, you know, how do you know one kind of watch seller or one scarf seller sort of thing? But they said, oh, no, you know when you know. You see them when you know. And when I began to notice them, then you do. They have a sort of a just a different look, a sort of thuggy, tough, unpleasant, sneery sort of look. And you just instantly realize that this is not, you know, that there are too many of them around and they weren't there before and they're not usually there. And they look a bit menacing and they just have a different kind of look. And it's quite clear, you know, that they're not really there for merchandising.
The regime has launched full-out assaults on the cities of Deraa and Hama. Are the security forces operating on a shoot-to-kill orders there?
I don't know. I don't know, and I don't think anybody really understands what the specific policies or strategy or tactics of the regime is. You know, they have simultaneously touted reform and promised reform and allowed sort of opposition conferences and convened their own conferences while violently cracking down on protesters. And it's very hard to know what they think they're doing or how they think they're going to get through, whether it's just a case of fear-mongering or whether they ruthlessly want to stamp it out and just see the violence as the way forward. It's hard to second-guess what those orders are, to be honest.
Well, the crackdown is a lot less violent than what Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez, ordered in Hama to quell a 1982 uprising. 20 to 30,000 people were killed there, weren't there?
Yeah, it's true. There's a sort of as many. I think the figures that Human Rights Watch people are human rights activists are giving for Syria now is sort of in excess of 2,000 killed over 5 or 6 months. But I suspect, and other diplomats kind of intimated this to me, this kind of tip of the iceberg stuff. The numbers are really hard to verify, and there are all sorts of anecdotal stuff you hear about, you know, massacres and roundings up and people being shot. And I suspect when this has all died down, and depending on whether journalists and other people will be able to get in and really try and figure out what happened in some of these places, you know, the stories will be harder. So there's a sense that this is kind of Hafez light. But still, the violence and the attrition is pretty bad. You know, when you go out to demonstrate, you have to pretty much contend that you're very likely to be shot at and you're very likely to be arrested. And certainly I heard horrible, terrible tales of torture and detention. And because of the security services are myriad, when you're arrested, you really have no idea who's got you, where you'll be held, how long you'll be held for, what's going to happen to you. You know, family members have almost no recourse at all. You go to a place you think your loved one might be held. They won't give you any information. And you expose yourself and other family members by even asking. So the intimidation tactics and the arrest go hand in hand with the actual death toll.
And the level of violence can be rather scary. People have been run over by tanks.
Yeah, I mean, the level of violence is scary, but it's also, I mean, it's hard to imagine. I talk to, for example, doctors and nurses who are doing an extraordinary job of going undercover stealthily into neighborhoods around in Damascus, for example, where there have been demonstrations and there are wounded, often with gunshot wounds, who dare not go to hospital. And one of them told me that one of the colleagues involved in this had been recently arrested from hospital. And doctors have been intimidated, nurses have been intimidated. I mean, the pervasiveness of this is really ugly.
I'm talking with Wendell Stevenson, whose article, Roads to Freedom, is in the August 29th issue of The New Yorker. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Wendell Stevenson, whose article, Roads to Freedom, appears in the August 29th issue of The New Yorker, the current issue of The New Yorker. The UN Human Rights Council has announced a probe into the violence against anti-government protesters, including possible crimes against humanity. Is that likely to amount to much? Threats of legal action haven't made much of an impact in Sudan, for example.
It's been interesting in the last couple of weeks. You know, really, we've seen an unprecedented sort of consensus of international pressure. Everybody from the King of Saudi Arabia to President Obama has, you know, condemned in the very strongest terms the violence the regime is visiting on its population. None of this seems to have had very much effect. I think on the day before, the morning that Obama was due to give his speech, where he was finally going to say, it had been long mooted and waited for, that he would say, you know, Bashar al-Assad should step down. I think Bashar went on state TV to say that the crackdown was over, and but people could continue to meet violence at protests. So it's very hard to know what effect the international community and threat of sanctions and condemnation is having. I suspect it's having some effect, but the regime is pretty opaque, and it's hard to tell just what.
But judging from its actions, you think that the Assad regime has learned lessons from watching the fall of Tunisia's Ben Ali, Egypt's Mubarak, and now what's going on with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya?
I don't know. I can only imagine, and the evidence seems to be because they've ramped up their crackdown and the violence seems to be continuing, if not increasing, that they have decided that it's a zero-sum game and that it's either them or the protesters. And they don't see a way, I think, to negotiate. There's been no, or to moderate or to stop or halt or sit down. That they've decided that that's not going to be the way forward. And I think they can fight their way out. They must think they can do it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be attempting to do it.
But on the other hand, as you pointed out, the regime has offered a number of reforms, like repealing the emergency law and proposing a new law allowing independent political parties, which I can't imagine could be taken all that seriously in light of the nature of this crackdown. But will any of those concessions satisfy the protesters?
Well, the crackdown just makes them moot. You know, the continuing violence makes them, just seem sort of absurd and moot. I talked to protesters and activists in Damascus who said, you know, if we'd had these things 10 years, 6 months ago or a year ago to be promised, elections to be promised, and a new party law that would allow for parties apart from the Ba'ath Party or those affiliated with it to be legal. If we had seen a repeal of the emergency law that I think has been in place since the early 60s, we couldn't have dreamed of such concessions. But they just seem too late, too little, false at this point, and just moot. You know, it doesn't really matter what's on paper. This has never been a regime that's particularly adhered to the letter of the law, and certainly not at the moment.
Well, one activist that you spoke with said that the regime is in a bind. It can't enact meaningful reforms because any crack in the system would bring down the entire state edifice. So what does Assad have left in his toolbox to end this crisis?
I don't know. I don't know what he thinks he can do about it, because I think he thinks... I don't know. I can't put myself in his place. It's sort of too speculative. But I can only assume that he thinks he can suppress this, and he has tried to do that.
Well, when he came to go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, perhaps he has tried to do that. I think that he has it somehow in his head to pursue a dual tack of repression and reform. But neither is appeasing the street.
Well, he kind of inherited the presidency after his father died in 2000. And wasn't he initially imagined to be a reformer? When did that change?
I think so. I mean, it's interesting. You know, he's young. He's kind of dynamic. He goes out. He sits in restaurants. His wife is, you know, nice and smart and personable and grew up in England and was born in Britain. And I think there was a sense that this was sort of the next generation. You know, the modernizers, and that with his accession to the presidency would come, a chink of light. And there was, in 2000, when he became president, there was a Damascus Spring that saw activist and the sort of cultural liberal elite of Damascus having sort of salons and talking about the future and being able to air certain kind of political questions and debate that had really never, you know, had not been possible even to have these conversations and gatherings for decades. But that was quickly stamped out pretty quickly by some high-profile arrests. And the promise of that, you know, never came to fruition. He's hinted, he's mooted at reform from time to time, but never followed it through. What he has done is done a sort of measure of economic liberalization, a little bit like Hosni Mubarak did in Egypt, or his son Gamal pushed, you know, the possible, probable heir apparent at one point. But, you know, much like Egypt, I think that while you can certainly see a lot more sort of prosperous and modernization in central Damascus than when I was first there 5 or 6 years ago now, more businesses and more Westerny-looking stuff and a lot more tourists and this kind of thing, it hasn't trickled down much, and it has been seen, much like it was in Egypt, to have the prosperity to have collected in a few hands, and those hands to have been, you know, very closely, directly linked to the regime. So that was the kind of, the new face, not a political reform, but a certain amount of economic liberalization.
I was also thinking of Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif. He was educated at the London School of Economics and then led the brutal crackdown against the Libyan uprising. Assad studied ophthalmology, which I don't know whether that prepares you to become the leader of a country, but he studied that in London, and well, both were assumed to have been, had to have been influenced by Western thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the assumption that I think is apparently not borne out.
Was that wishful thinking?
I think so, and I think I think that they thought of themselves as reformers, you know, in their own terms. But in both cases, you know, you're looking at really a sort of family affair, and I can't, you know, imagine what it's like to be sort of part of that coterie or that system, that culture, which is it's a little bit sort of running countries with, you know, mafia families. That's sort of what it is in both cases. It's a different set of rules.
Now, there is something like a dozen branches to the Syrian security services. Why are there so many?
I don't know. Nobody could tell me exactly how many. Diplomats kind of threw, you know, when I asked, they would kind of throw their hands open in sort of mock surrender at the question. But I think it was probably part of, you know, the way to divide and conquer their own. I mean, regimes like this tend to fear their own security services and their own military institutions the most. To a certain extent, that's where coups come from and that's where threats come from. So if you divide, I'm guessing a bit in the Syrian case, but if you divide them, you can sometimes control them better.
Well, in other countries, the military stepped in to fill the vacuum to rule the country, at least in the interim, probably longer than that, after the fall of the dictator. Is that likely to be the situation in Syria in case Assad actually is deposed?
I don't know. I mean, anything is possible. Only a fool would have the temerity prediction in these things. I mean, I think that the army, as I can tell, has been, you know, fairly seen as to be a tool of the regime at the moment. And although it's been, a lot of protesters have made it clear to me that when the army goes into certain cities and stuff, it's generally in sort of support and intimidation of the security services that go in and crack down and hardline and go house to house and are really at the sort of coal face of the crackdown, clampdown of the protesters. And, you know, parking tanks, driving tanks around and sort of this sort of thing has often been more of an intimidatory thing. They have engaged directly in some places. I think the security services are what most people feel, you know, is the thing that they're battling the most. There has been anecdotal evidence of, you know, there's been all sorts of stories and some borne out, some much muddier tales of, you know, clumps of people defecting from the army. It's hard to know how widespread that is or not. Or what the mood is inside the army. Anecdotally, I did hear from, you know, friends and friends of friends who some people have been called up you know, at this moment for their military service. So they're essentially conscripts who are sort of chafing, feeling very ill at ease and awkward about the role they're having to play in this. And while I was in Syria, so there was the kind of odd and news that the defense minister, who'd been in his position for some time, had been resigned or sidelined. And it was very hard to guess, you know, what kind of fracture that event might have suggested in the regime. But it was kind of, I talked about it with several people in Damascus, and everybody was like, who knows what this means? But presumably, in some way, it illustrates some sort of fissure, some sort of crack there. But it's hard to tell who might emerge from the military to pull a division or something in a different direction. I think that it's one of the scenarios, a break in the military or a coup of that nature, that people, protesters kind of cross their fingers about. But how likely it is really hard to tell.
But doesn't the Assad regime also enjoy a certain amount of support from various parts of the Syrian elite, the business community, people who see it as a stabilizing influence?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, you know, Syria is between Lebanon on one side and Iraq on the other. And for a long time, the Assad regime was able to play the, you know, stability and security card. And I think that there are still plenty of people, and some I talk to in Damascus, who are kind of in the middle, and particularly, you know, business elites and merchants and professional classes who are doing okay and have their lives and everything is fine. They worry a lot about the aftermath and the insecurities and the melee that will come.
And then there are the Alawites, who are the tribe that the Assad family comes from, who might very well suffer if there were a change in regime.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Alawites, which is a sort of a sect of sort of dissident sect of Shiism, kind of, that the Assad family comes from, particularly frightened of the aftermath and what an aftermath might bring. And who knows? I mean, obviously, all the protesters I talked to, and among them was a young Alawite lady, have been at pains to stress that this is not a sectarian issue. This is an issue about freedom and democracy, and they want all sects to be able to share in that future. But it's hard to imagine that a community that has been so identified with the regime would not suffer at least loss of status, if not a certain amount of backlash afterwards. So I don't think their fears are misplaced. They're just, I think that they're in a tricky position.
In other uprisings, we've heard a lot about the impact of the internet and cell phones. Doesn't Bashar al-Assad's cousin own the country's largest cell phone network?
He does.
So that would make it a little harder to get your message across in this case?
It's very difficult to communicate because there's an assumption that your cell phone is tapped and listened to, text messages are read, and that emails are read. So it's very, you know, people are very circumspect in what you can communicate over these mediums. And it was a real feature of being there that you're constantly sort of text messaging in code and changing out SIM cards and, you know, really only being able to communicate with people face to face and then looking over your shoulder in a cafe and wondering about it. The internet is patchy. They shut it down or the access to certain sites are blocked and up and down. Skype is considered sort of safer but is quite hard, sometimes accessible, sometimes not. So the kind of normal communications are very constrained.
People are texting things like, are you throwing a party? You also write about a number of low-tech communication methods, including sending messages tucked in packages of dates and taped to ping pong balls thrown from high buildings. Are these working? Are they effective?
I think they're less messages than some efforts, you know, the creative kind to try and demonstrate in central Damascus where the security presence is so great that it's just impossible to map, it's impossible to gather. And so people have been trying to be creative in terms of just saying we're here fleetingly. So they've somebody sent over there through taped messages of freedom onto ping pong balls and threw them off a high building. Mm. They write freedom on banknotes, you know, in the sense that currency has to pass hands until the banks refuse to accept any notes that had any markings on them at all. When I was there, the center of Damascus was enjoying a small spate of what they call flying demonstrations, because you can't gather in any place before the security services will show up. You know, you kind of try and gather maybe 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 people in one place, and you're just there. You shout and chant, you take pictures on mobile phones and upload them to the internet if you can, and you're just there for sort of 5 or 10 minutes, and then you scatter before they have a chance to sort of show up and realize you're there and realize that that's happened.
Wendy, I have just 30 seconds. You spoke to a number of activists in Syria. Do they honestly believe they're going to topple this regime?
They hope so.
Do you think that that's a realistic hope? I mean, some of the other... The other uprisings have been successful, but they've been quite different than this one. And we don't see a rebel army marching on Damascus.
I don't know. There's no way to know right now. But I was extremely impressed by the fortitude and courage of those who have, you know, sustained this effort in the face of pretty sustained violent reaction.
Wendell Stevenson's article, Roads to Freedom, is in the August 29th issue of The New Yorker, the current issue. Thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi talks about his latest article, Is the SEC Covering Up Wall Street Crimes? And then Rye Barkhad on his efforts to start a nonprofit in Kibera, the huge slum of Nairobi, Kenya. Also, Peter Spiegelman on his new novel, Thick as Thieves, plus an underreported Michaela Wrong fills us in on the shocking situation in Eritrea. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Rachel Hartman, Christina Maldonado, and Sarah Waltuck. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.